Roxanne turned and walked down the main aisle toward the podium, around which the expectant council members were already seated in rows of cushioned, low-slung seats. He walked up the four wood steps to the podium and took a seat to the right of the Speaker of the Chamber.
First Commander Ted Roxon, I, on behalf of the entire council, indeed all of Century City, would like to congratulate you on the success of the mission. May there be many more in the future.
Thank you. But we're fighting a giant here. Losses of this amount over the course of a year add up to 10 or 20,000 troops across the country. To the Red Leaders, that's nothing. Nothing. We need a way for our attacks to be 100 times more violent, deadly, and destructive. We need to make them hurt. Now, let's get to the most serious matter immediately. The capture of Preston. This situation endangers not only Westfort, but our own Century City as well.
Truer words were never spoken. The 80-story circular monolith sat in the center of Denver, a statue of death. Black as night, sheathed in impenetrable shimmering glass, it reached up to the sky, the highest structure in the KGB fortress of Vostok, the center of KGB operations in America. The monolith, called just the center by its personnel, and the death house by the Americans, had been built to terrify, to frighten, to intimidate. And it did. Erected nearly 60 years earlier by Commander Yargov, the fourth of the KGB leaders in the occupied United States, it had been constructed of the finest materials, hardened steel, and specially made triple polarized brownish-blue tinted glass to withstand the sun and dust of the Colorado climate. Yargov ordered it to last as long as the Empire, and it would be standing well after that. Still as mysterious and conspicuous as the day it was built, some 200 feet in diameter was the base of all KGB operations in the USA. Over 9,000 men and women worked here daily, pulling up to work early each morning in their Pushka three-wheel cars or on motorcycle. The monolith was set in the center of the KGB fortress, separate from the military base or its housing. The KGB demanded its own space. It did not want to mix. The meaning of the KGB was fear, to watch over the Soviet military as well as the American workers. Fraternization meant familiarization and friendship. This could not be, not the black shirts. Their black uniforms and red death's head medallions designated that they were out of the ordinary. An image must be created of immortality, of superhuman strength and violence. And that was how it must be, for fear worked only when it was believed. Within the walls of the center, myriad functions were carried out. From information fed in from military operations, informers, spy drones, and the KGB's own network of intelligence operatives, a comprehensive picture was drawn of the rebel activity and the trouble spots around the country. The intelligence units occupied 25 floors filled with maps, floor to ceiling, contoured maps of the entire country, flashing with different colored lights to designate the trouble spots. Green lights for environmental dangers, from earthquakes to radioactive mists, red lights for rebel attacks, orange lights for possible free American hidden cities, and blue lights for all other KGB centers in the USA. Messengers constantly ran from floor to floor as their superiors yelled out orders. The sheer enormity of spying on such a vast country as the United States was a constant struggle. There were always problems, always emergencies. Breakdowns of equipment, rebellions, sabotage of the factories and the Russian fortresses by the underground. The army were fools, barely capable of going out and capturing a few rebels, let alone understanding the whole picture, the emerging pattern. That work was for the KGB. On the next 15 floors were the counter-espionage services, ruling bureaucracy that sent out the death squads to liquidate all those thought to be troublemakers. There were no laws they had to obey. They were the law, the judge, the jury, and the executioner. From the 41st to the 64th floor were the communications networks, linking all KGB centers in the country with Mother Russia and their comrades in arms around the world. From Timbuktu to London, from Paris to Tokyo, the KGB ruled supreme. Radio, laser systems, and giant radar dishes on the roof, slowly turning their 50-foot cones to follow their linking satellite hundreds of miles up. Information was sent and received from virtually every corner of the world. The wires literally buzzed with energy as the global Soviet Empire talked to itself. On the top 15 floors were the administration offices of top KGB officers. Here, the rooms were huge and plush, with Persian rugs and flowing copper waterfalls. The elite of the elite, their death's heads cast in solid gold. The most feared men in America ruled from here. Turgenev, Dashkov, Mukhstat, Kilov. Below the ground floor, the original designers of the monolith had built an additional 10 stories, pushing a good 150 feet below the ground. Here, it was thought, just in case of counterattack, the structure could be used as a fallout shelter, and thus was built with 20-foot-thick concrete-reinforced walls, a self-contained oxygen supply, and provisions for years. But the KGB had quickly found a much better use for these subterranean floors, a use more fitting to their work, torture chambers. The floors beneath the center were equipped with over 500 cells, in case large-scale interrogations became necessary. The most advanced and primitive torture devices known to man were here, a regular testing laboratory of the implements of pain. From bamboo shoots inserted under fingernails, still effective on many American fortress workers, to sophisticated electrode devices, which when attached to the genitals were capable of producing an exquisite pain. The torture squad consisted of nearly 100 men, the most sadistic of the KGB crews, who had been chosen just for their qualities of mercilessness and cruelty. Down below, they had their own world. There were no rules, no one to answer to. Most of those that set foot through those basement doors were never seen again. The few that were released were mindless vegetables, their bodies ripped, scarred, their brains reduced to functions of stumbling and excreting. Most could hardly talk, or if they could, wouldn't. They sat on stoops and in glass and brick-strewn lots in the rundown American sectors of the fortresses and moaned softly, unable to communicate their private hell. Fortunately for them, most did perish within the walls. If death could be termed fortunate, it was here that such a designation would occur. For the KGB of 2089 were experts in every kind of pain that the human body could experience. They studied the ways of pain, the uses of pressure points, blades, electricity, beatings, ice, and others. When death came, it was a blessing. Still, there was one thing that grated on the torture squads: the free Americans. Somehow, their own scientists and psychologists had come up with psychological conditioning that could overcome pain. They felt the torture, but blocks came on in their minds that permitted no access to the secret information that the KGB wanted most desperately: the locations of the American free cities. The Americans would scream and then spout nursery rhymes, the name of their girlfriend, or their favorite food. They had been totally incapable of breaking through these walls. Until now. The number one priority of the KGB scientists for the last 20 years had been to develop some method, some device capable of smashing through these blocks. And now, at last, success was within reach. The Mind Breaker, invented by Dr. Nikolai Chernov, would make the difference. The device used concentrated lasers to actually penetrate the brain tissue and short out the brain's ability to block pain. It would surgically slice vital brain connections, producing a pain undreamt of heretofore. The demons of hell itself would be happy to have such a machine. Kilov immediately ordered extensive testing of the Mind Breaker. If it was true, the shape of America could be changed forever. The last strongholds of resistance to the Soviet Empire would be crushed, and Russia could settle into 1,000 years of tranquility. Of course, Kilov's future would be assured as well. With the destruction of the rebels, he would be next in line for the premiership. Every prisoner brought in from now on was to be hooked up to the Mind Breaker. He wanted every detail of the machine: how it worked, what its limits were, if any. But most of all, He wanted the locations of the free cities. Blood would flow. Lieutenant Colonel Bill Preston, one of the highest-ranking officers of Westport, located some 500 miles to the east of Denver, had been captured. It was one of the Reds' biggest catches in years. Once delivered, Preston was immediately pushed toward the back entrance of the center. Death's Head guards, stiffly at attention, saluted and stepped aside. The captured free fighter was hustled inside the inner airlock. He was led to one of the 10 gleaming chrome elevators and rode it down. Preston felt a knot in his gut as the elevator descended. He tried to imagine what awaited him, but knew it would be far worse than anything his sane mind could picture. The elevator snapped open, and again he was pushed out. They led him down a long corridor filled with countless numbered doors. At the end of the corridor, they came to yet another large steel door. The guards saluted the officer at Preston's right. Preston was pulled into a fairly small room, equipped with futuristic equipment, blinking computer lights, diodes, dials, video cameras, and a large gridded screen. All the guards exited quickly, except two who stood by him, hands at ease behind them. Preston looked around furtively. There were no whips or chains here. Somehow, he had imagined a more primitive dungeon, with racks and burning pokers. Instead, there was only a simple plastic chair, body contoured with aluminum arms and straps for the wrists. It was the object that waited on a mobile stand above the chair that looked forbidding, a large helmet covered with wires and meters. In the center underneath, right where the head would fit when the helmet was lowered, two 6-inch-long syringe-like prongs. The device seemed to be wired to some kind of computer terminal, rows of green and blue lights softly glowing, waiting to flash with life. As he swung his head around, he saw a large piece of glass about 10 feet off the floor, and behind it, a number of KGB officers stood, talking and laughing. They stopped when they saw him taking them in, and all stared back down at the prisoner.
Welcome, Mr. Preston. Welcome to this center. I am Director Kiloff. Perhaps you've heard of me.
Yes, I've heard of you, Kiloff. You're the greatest mass murderer alive in the world today. Any loyal American would give his beating heart to see you dead.
You flatter me. To be so notorious a man to you so-called free fighters just fuels me with happiness.
Murder is nothing to be proud of. Your day will come, that I know. Why don't you just kill me and get it over with?
Kill you? Oh, no, Mr. Preston, we have much greater things in store for you than that. How unimaginative of you. Don't you see that device near you? The chair with the metal head? Won't you have a seat?
The officers around Kiloff smiled victoriously as Preston tried to struggle with the two hulking guards who grabbed him and strapped him quickly to the chair. From a side door, a man emerged wearing a white smock and surgical gloves. He moved slowly over to Preston, a short, fat man with thinning brown hair and black eyes that were dead. Preston shuddered as the man looked him full in the face. He had never seen eyes like that before. They seemed to have no life behind them at all, total blackness that fell back like a stone dropping into a deep well, never touching bottom.
I am Dr. Yurov, if you will allow me.
He reached above Preston's head and lowered the helmet, attached to a curved stainless steel arm, until it was halfway covering Preston's face. The points of the twin surgical probes rested just an inch above the free American skull. Yurov pressed a button on the side of the black helmet that resembled a kind of ultra-modern diving helmet as it covered the prisoner's head. Two foam pads slowly eased out of each side of the helmet and moved forward until tightly pressed against Preston's temples. He tried to move, but his head was totally immobilized now. He began trembling in spite of himself.
Ready, sir.
The KGB leader merely nodded once and waited. An orderly, carrying a tray of drinks, walked around to Kiloff and the other top officers, giving out brandies and scotches, and Kiloff's drink, straight gin. Yurov stroked the hair away from the center of Preston's head, looked at the spot of bared scalp, and nodded to himself. He lowered the two prongs until they rested right on the flesh at the very top of the skull. The KGB doctor walked to the large control panel along one wall, covered with flickering video screens, readouts, computer-drawn graphs of CAT scans of Preston's brain that were being taken by a camera at the top of the helmet every 4 seconds. Yurov switched the laser on button, and a row of dark green crystal diodes stretching along a chrome metal cabinet behind the prisoner's chair instantly lit up.
Now, this is going to hurt. It's going to hurt quite a bit. So the best thing I can say to you is to give in to it. The quicker you surrender your personality, your thoughts, your obedience, the quicker the pain would be over.
Oh, cut all the goddamn bullshit and torture me. I'm getting bored.
But despite his tough words, Preston steeled his guts and his very soul for what was about to come. Yurov threw a switch at the top of the metal helmet, and two brilliant lights shot out from the ends of the needle-sharp prongs. The lights were of an extraordinary green, like the starfire of a burning gem, incandescent. Yurov slowly began turning a small lever, which lowered the probes toward Preston's skull. The heat of the laser beams shooting out from the tips instantly vaporized the flesh and bone at the top of the Free Fighter's head. The probes continued burning through at 10 millimeters per second. The green laser probe burned and sizzled away at the brain tissue, bubbling it and disintegrating it into putrid smoke that rose from the top of Preston's head.
That's apparently one of the only problems, sir. They say the brains smell quite awful as they burn.
Really? The Premier won't like that at all when we demonstrate this for him. Tell them that something will have to be worked out. A miniature ventilation fan to suck in the smoke and odor. Priority.
My CAT scan shows that we are now reaching the cerebral section, sir. Now is when the process actually starts. You see, as I burn away the older memory systems and also apply excruciating pain, the patient is put into an entirely different consciousness. Watch.
Preston no longer knew who he was. Memories of his life, his wife and daughter, were ripped and torn from his mind. The pain was so intense, pushing everything to the side as it gripped him in claw-like vices of sensation. He was being sliced by razor blades of liquid fire, slashed open and cut, his backbone and veins, his gut and his tongue, and his boiling eyes, all cut and twisted into knots of flame. At last, all he was his body. And his body was sheer, infinite, unbearable pain.
Good. Good. I will now revive him with the smelling salts.
Proceed.
Now, that wasn't so bad, was it? Now, just one more question and then you can go to sleep. Where is your city?
Preston's eyes half opened, dead. He didn't understand. He had no past memory beyond the last few hours. He was afraid. So afraid. These men, they had hurt him. He was an animal, dumb, unaware even of humanity.
Your city! Your city!
My city? Yes. No, I should tell. Why? There's a reason. Why shouldn't I tell you?
I'll have to use the probes again.
No, no! It's just about 300 miles west of here. West Fork. Just inside Three Valleys, where the Falls River splits into two. It's hidden in the trees and is... I messed myself.
Good. Very good. That's all for today. Let me take this helmet off of you. Ah. Now, Preston. We'll meet again.
Dr. Yurov applied an antiseptic to the 2/4-inch holes at the top of his skull, followed by a gauze pad and bandage. The guards took the nearly catatonic free American off to one of the holding cells for future interrogation.
Excellent, Dr. Yurov. Excellent. Your device more than lives up to its reputation. I'm very pleased. I want to see more, but first, the city must be disposed of.
Kilov exited from the viewing booth, with the officers following closely behind. Dr. Yurov tidied up.
Such a good machine. Such a good machine.
Yurov was almost stroking the helmet as he wheeled it on its stand back against the wall.